Sairam, dear listeners, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai. Offering my loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, I welcome you to this week's episode, but not of the Gita series. We have completed the second chapter and I promise that I'll do a summary of the second chapter. But I think that will have to wait for a week, because right now I'm not in Prashanthi Nilayam and I'm not coming to you live. But nevertheless, I'm going to leave you with a talk that is based, of course, on Swami's message, but an aspect of Swami's message which I think I have not covered thus far in any of my programs or in the course of the Bhagavad Gita session so far. This is a talk that I gave on the topic Brahmacharya, the Royal Path. And this is, of course, is based on a very important aspect of spiritual life that Swami has spoken about. I try to deal with some of the misconceptions on the topic and how it is relevant for us, whichever stage in life we are in. I'm not going to let you reveal more than that to you. I'll let you listen to the talk. I'll come back next week and probably we'll take it from there. I again seek your indulgence for me not being able to continue with the Gita series for this week. But I hope you'll enjoy this talk, and as always, you can send me your feedback as to what you liked about the talk or what you felt I missed out. You can send me your feedback directly to me, or you can send it to listener@radiosai.org and they will pass it on to me. I hope you enjoy this talk. I'll meet you all again next week. Till then, happy listening. Here is a talk on the topic Brahmacharya, the Royal Path. I offer my most loving pranams at Bhagavan's lotus feet. I pray to Swami that He gives us all the understanding. That is, it is He who speaks and it is He who listens to all of us. Sairam, elders, sisters and brothers, very warm good morning. This happened to one of our Swami's students when he was staying in the hostel. When all of a sudden he took this fascination for meditation. Right? So he was reading a lot about Hatha Yoga, Kundalini Yoga and all of these things. So he said, you know, we should take up something like this to please Swami, because after all, you are in an institute which is so different. You are in the presence of Swami. So he thought it's befitting that one really does some rigorous sadhana like that. And around the same time, Swami gave a discourse on how one should do jyoti meditation. So he thought it was very propitious and appropriate. So he took up the practice of jyoti meditation. If you see in Vrindavan, there are two hostel buildings. One is the hostel where the students stay. And there is another building just beside it, which is pretty much empty throughout the year. When Swami is in Vrindavan, devotees would be allowed to stay in that building. So this boy thought that it's a nice place to go sit in solitude and do this jyoti meditation. I'm sure most of you would be aware of how Swami has spoken of how the jyoti meditation must be done. You light a candle or a lamp in front of you, you look at the flame, and then you internalize the flame, and then you take it through the various limbs of the body, and Swami would say, even as you are picturizing that, you pray that Swami sublimates and purifies each one of these instruments. So this boy said, all right, we'll do this. So he lit a candle. It was a dark, lonely place, and he began his meditation. He did it for a couple of days, and then he found that the flame was not steady, because there was some gentle movement in the air, so because of which the flame was not steady, and that was very distracting. So what did he do? He took a 200-page notebook, which had a hard cover, and he made a V-shaped enclosure for that candle. So he put it like that, and he began doing his meditation, and he was waiting for that moment when he would have some experience, as Swami had explained in the discourse, and of course, as he has read in many books. Months went by, but he did not have any experience. Then one fine day, when he was sitting there with his eyes closed and doing this jyoti meditation, he began feeling a certain warmth. And he said, finally, the experience is here. And even as he was meditating, he could find the effulgence growing. And he said, wow, here it is after all this while. So he was very happy within. But just a few moments later, the warmth became a little more uncomfortable. So out of curiosity, he opened his eye, and what he found in front of him was a huge flame. The notebook had tipped over, got burnt, and there was this small bonfire in front of him. He was absolutely disappointed. But it's not an experience you can speak about, right? If you have some spiritual experience, then it can become a part of your speech. But this is not something you go around telling people, and people will laugh at you. So he kept quiet. He didn't tell this to anybody. A few days went by, and the students were all standing around Swami's bungalow. And one day Swami comes out, and that was the time when Swami used to spend a lot of time just lingering around that place. Boys were not even seated. They would just be filling the corridors, and Swami would walk around, speak to them. As this brother himself was narrating, there used to be this beautiful arch of a creeper around the door. So it would be a practice that even as Swami would walk past that door, they would pull that creeper, which the branch which had flowers, and they would hold it just for Swami to take a sniff, and then they would let it back. It almost became like a ritual, like all of these small, small things. There would be people peering through the window and people sitting around Swami's throne and lining Swami's path. So that day Swami comes by, looks at this boy and calls him. And Swami says, hey, if you keep staring at the candle light, you'll become mad. Crack aipotavra, Swami said, you'll become a madman. Then Swami said, knack ledante crack aipotav. If you don't have the knack, then you'll become a crack. Right? He had not told this to anybody, and nobody knows it, and here Swami was telling. But then the beautiful thing was, this brother narrates, standing there that day, Swami gave an entire discourse for almost an hour on what it is to meditate. Right? And then Swami, on that occasion, spoke about what is popularly known as Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga, the eighth step yoga. And Swami said, Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana and Samadhi. Dhyana is the penultimate step and Samadhi is the last. Do you think simply by sitting in front of a lamp and closing your eyes for a few minutes, you can straight go to Dhyana? Swami said, the foundation is important. Right? That's precisely what we do. We sit in an asana, which is a posture. We close our eyes. We imagine that we are meditating, which is Dhyana, and we claim that we are in Samadhi. Swami says it's not so easy. Do you think for no reason the sages and saints have been sitting in the cold Himalayas and being practicing meditation? Because it is not so easy. And then Swami went on to say, don't worry about all of that. Focus on the fundamentals. Swami said, Yama Niyama, concentrate on that. What is this Yama and Niyama? Probably I'll quickly say what are those eight in case anybody doesn't follow. Yama means the disciplines that we have to maintain in a society when we are in the presence of others. Niyama is personal discipline. Even if you're in the desert with nobody around you, you still have to follow these disciplines. That is Niyama. Asana Pranayama, of course, most of us are aware. Pratyahara is withdrawal of the senses. Dharana is concentration. Dhyana is meditation. And Samadhi is the complete sublimation of the mind. And Swami was saying, Yama and Niyama are the foundation. So Swami has made the syllabus easy for us. In fact, on another occasion when Swami was speaking in a discourse, Swami said, Niyama also is not required. Concentrate only on Yama. For leading a life filled with values, just following Yama is enough. That is, what is the discipline that we maintain in life when we are interacting with people around us. So it appears like so simple. Thank you, Swami, we don't have to worry about the eight. We can just concentrate on the one. But then Swami says, this one has five aspects to it. He says, this yama is fivefold. What is that? Swami says, satya, ahimsa, asteya, aparigraha, and the topic of the day, brahmacharya. Swami says, satya is truthfulness, being truthful, being genuine. Ahimsa is not harming others or not being a cause for the harm the others feel. Asteya is non-stealing, right? The actual meaning of the word is non-stealing. Swami says it is not having any desire for anything that does not belong to you or rightfully is, you are deserving of that. What you don't deserve, what you don't have, you should not desire for that. That is asteya. Aparigraha means, it is very similar to asteya, but Swami defines it very simply for us so that practically we can understand. Swami says, not accepting gift from others. Because that spoils the mind in a certain manner. That's, of course, for a different day. It's not the topic of the day. But Swami says, aparigraha. And finally, Swami says, brahmacharya. Brahmacharya, which is very loosely translated, means celibacy. The moment we say brahmacharya is a prerequisite for the ultimate merger or samadhi or dhyana, the householders and those who are married will say, all right, so we are not part of that then. We are already out of the race. In fact, if you look at it, the misunderstanding of what this value of brahmacharya is precisely the cause for the idea that spirituality is only for sannyasis. Brahmacharya, yes, as simply defined, is celibacy, but Swami says there is brahmacharya even in grihasthashrama. Even in the stage where you are a householder, when you're married, there is a certain brahmacharya that needs to be followed. The other confusion, of course, comes from brahmacharya being the name of the first stage of life. Right? Swami would often speak of it as the four-storied mansion, where brahmacharya or celibacy or the celibate state is the ground floor. The grihasthashrama or being a householder is the second floor. The third is, of course, vanaprastha, and the final is sannyasa. So as people in the world, what do we think? Celibacy is for people who either choose to be a brahmachari all their life, or they are so old that they have already come to the sannyasa phase. So in between, I don't need to bother about that. So what is this brahmacharya which Swami refers to? There is a simple understanding. Of course, thinking of it as celibacy and continence is not wrong. It has its value. But looking at it as something more subtle than that is also very, very important in the spiritual path. Swami would say that the brahmacharya ashrama, or that celibate state, is like the foundation. If that is shaking, the whole building will collapse. And not only is it a foundation, but it is an undercurrent which runs through all of these stages of life. It's almost like probably the grammar that we learn in school, or let's say the calculus that we learn in school. You would probably have one subject which is named after that topic, English grammar, Sanskrit grammar, or calculus 101, calculus 102. But that does not mean that we will not use those concepts later. In fact, we will constantly keep using those concepts. So same is the case with brahmacharya. It's just that in that first stage, we are meant to concentrate on that, and there is a certain way in which it has to be observed. What is the brahmacharya that Swami expects in the first stage? Well, we don't have to search much for that. You just have to see how Swami expects his students to live. That's precisely what Swami would expect. That there is complete control over any form of distraction in that age. Celibacy followed in thought, word and deed is what Swami would expect. There's no question of how that has to be looked at. Invariably, when we say brahmacharya, we think of it as synonymous with purity. Right? Invariably, we say that somebody is a celibate means somebody is pure. It's not that if you're not celibate, you're impure, but we have that in the mind, isn't it? And we'll hold on to that thought, we'll come back to that later, because brahmacharya is a form of purity. But in this stage of life, in this student stage of life, Swami would say that that practice of brahmacharya should express itself as this form of purity. Complete withdrawal from any kind of attraction from the opposite gender. Swami was very, very clear about that. And there are many, many stories as students we know that invariably any form of Swami taking the students to task, Swami being upset with us, telling of anything. It's not only about this. In fact, I recall when I was in my second year undergraduate, it was Swami's birthday time. It was during the Akhanda Bhajan. We all know after the Akhanda Bhajan, there is prasadam distribution, right? So during that prasadam distribution, while serving the sweet pongal, one of my classmates did not serve it properly and he spilt it on one of the devotees sitting there. One of the devotees who was sitting in the portico. I'm not sure whether Swami observed it directly or somebody informed Swami about it or complained to Swami about it. Swami got so upset. Swami was very, very upset with that, and that scene is quite vivid. Swami was standing right in front of that Ganesh portico, in front of the third block, standing there for almost 45 minutes. Swami was shouting at all of us. Swami was scolding all of us. And it started off by saying, no concentration, no discipline. Don't you know what Swami expects of you? And all of that. It started with the chakra pongal not being served properly on the leaf. By the end of that 45 minutes, the topic had already come to boys going behind girls. How Swami connected it, I don't remember. But invariably, so many such occasions, Swami would come to that point. Because Swami wanted us to keep that in the top of our mind, that this is something which Swami expects of us. And there must be a way by which everything is connected. Probably we are not wise enough to say how it was connected, how concentration and discipline is connected to all of that. But Swami was always putting that on top of our mind. That if you want to please Swami, if you want to make Swami happy with your conduct, this becomes one of the very, very important things that needs to be followed. And Swami would go no end to create an atmosphere which is conducive for you to follow this. Many, many occasions, and there are n number of things which comes to my mind. For instance, there was once during the Spirit of Unity concerts which used to happen, right, in the Purnachandra Auditorium, many, many great artists have come and performed. On one evening, there was one very famous dancer who was supposed to make her performance. Very famous dancer. And when she was supposed to perform, Swami sends word to the hostel, today boys don't have to come. Till then, Swami was very particular that every day boys should be there in the audience. Because Swami was there, and Swami used to sit till sometimes 11 in the night, watching the performances. On that day, promptly Swami sends word, ee roju akkarledu, boys don't have to come. Because Swami was constantly thinking, was not suspecting our intentions, right? We are not bad in that sense, none of us are. But Swami was helping us, or helping to create an atmosphere around so that we can follow this value. And constantly, the way Swami would look at certain things, in fact, recently we were having this discussion, the year 2005, they had put up this drama of on the Independence Day. It was a phenomenal drama, it was very nice, Swami was extremely happy. They had made a backdrop of the Mother India in the form of the Indian map, dressed in the tricolor, holding the flag. You know, a typical image of Mother India was made there. Swami was extremely happy with everything. Swami was blessing. I think Swami gave ring to two or three boys who performed there. But Swami made an observation. Swami called one of the boys who made the sets. Swami said that sari is not covering her properly. He said, you have not drawn it properly. Right? Because Swami was sensitizing us to this is important to Swami. And this is the basis of Brahmacharya. We'll come to that. But in this stage when one is gathering knowledge, it becomes very, very important. Swami would often say this. He says, if you wish to be a Vidyarthi, you should cease to be a Vishayarthi. Right? A Vidyarthi is one who is trying to gather Vidya or knowledge. Arthi is one who craves, right? If you are a Vidyarthi, if you are craving for knowledge, you should not be a Vishayarthi. Vishaya means objects of the world, right? And Swami would say this even in the other context. It's not only about this particular topic. But in general, Swami would say, do you think I cannot provide each one of my students with a bed? Do you think I cannot afford to give each one of my students a separate room to live in? Swami would say, no, this much comfort is enough because they are students, they have to lead a simple life. This Spartan living is important for education. Right? So in that phase when one is going through that period of being a young adult, being a teenager, especially being a student, Swami would say it's very important that one follows this discipline of continence and celibacy. Now coming to the Brahmacharya in Grihastha Ashrama, that's a very interesting way of looking at it, right? Swami defines it in one sentence. Very, very crisply Swami puts it. In the Grihastha Ashrama, a person should follow Brahmacharya in the presence of women other than his wife. A grihastha becomes a brahmachari in the presence of women other than his wife. A grihini becomes a brahmacharini when in the presence of any other man other than her husband. As simple as that, brahmacharya does not cease, but it undergoes a certain modification. And this is a very, very important thing to keep in mind. This may appear like a no-brainer. This is very simple. But this is a very, very important thing that Swami is saying. In fact, it is the basis of very fundamental spiritual understanding. Before I talk about that, let me talk a little about a certain mechanism in the brain itself. I've made a mention of this a couple of times before, but I would like to go back to that. When we are talking about happiness, when we are talking about pleasure, happiness itself is of three different types. One is pleasure, the other is, for the lack of a better word, happiness, and the third is peace, comfort, calmness. Even that is a form of happiness, right? And the brain makes us feel pleasure, happiness, or calmness of satisfaction through a mechanism that happens in the brain. When we interact with the world outside, when we are placed in different situations and circumstances, the brain thinks of it as this is a pleasurable moment, this is a happy tiding, or this is a dangerous situation. And this, the brain has to inform to all other parts of the brain, or the necessary limbs of the body. And how does it do it? It communicates through what we refer to as neurotransmitters, right? It's just an electrical signal which is passed by certain chemicals which are called neurotransmitters. Right? And most of this happiness, what we feel, we are actually feeling in one part of the brain which is called the limbic system. And it's very interesting. The science behind this is very interesting. There are a couple of hormones like dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, and endorphin, right? These are the hormones which are secreted or which are released by these neurons when we are undergoing a happy moment, a pleasurable moment. And how it happens is, it's like there are two neurons. They don't touch each other. There's a small gap between two neurons. And this gap between the two neurons are referred to as the synapses. And these hormones are released. And as long as these hormones, which can be very loosely referred to as happy hormones, right? Easy to understand them that way. As long as these happy hormones are there in this synapses, we feel happy. But the mechanism is inbuilt into the brain that it releases these happy hormones, it communicates to the next neuron, but after some time it reabsorbs these hormones. And that is how pleasure becomes fleeting. Why is it that I eat an ice cream today and I am not able to feel the pleasure for 25 days? After some time it ceases. It's because it withdraws these happy hormones. It makes you feel that pleasure only for a certain time. And this is inbuilt into the brain purely for a simple reason, that the brain feels happy when you do actions which are beneficial to this body. Now when I was feeling thirsty, I took a sip of water. Automatically, drinking that water, I don't feel happy, not that kind of happiness. But actually in the brain, there are happy hormones which are being secreted. And it will be withdrawn so that next time I feel thirsty, which means next time my body is dehydrated, I will re-perform this task. So the brain makes me repeat the tasks which are beneficial to this body. Now it's very interesting if we were to go into the science of what we refer to as substance abuse or drug abuse or the usage of narcotics. The science behind it is very important to understand. You will see a beautiful connection between what happens there and what Swami says. And a disclaimer, these are all very rudimentary sciences. Right? Even though today what we know about the brain and its mechanism is very advanced compared to a couple of years ago, still it is not complete. But even with this limited knowledge, we can see where Swami is coming from. Now as I said, there are these happy hormones which are released, and after a certain brief time they are retraced by the neurons. So now when we take these substances like cocaine, heroin, meth, and all of these different names are there, right? What do these substances do? They make this happiness that we feel be experienced in a sustained manner. There are two ways in which they do it. Either they increase the secretion of these happy hormones, so you feel a burst of happiness, and they will go and block all of these reabsorption points, so that these happy hormones are lingering around in the brain for a little longer. And that is why that when they take those substances, they're like, I mean, each substance has different effects. Some give you that euphoria for 1 hour. Some give you that euphoric feeling for 12 hours. They make these happy hormones linger in your brain for longer. Seems like harmless. So what? Why not we feel happy for longer? What is wrong in that? But the human brain is very, very smart. It keeps observing the situation that is happening in the brain because some external agency has modified the equilibrium of the brain. So it strikes back. It wants to restore the balance. So what does it do now? It starts opening up more pores to pull back these happy hormones. So suppose a neuron has, say, 5 points to pull back the happy hormones. Because of this chain situation, the brain evolves to create something like 10 or 15 points where it can pull back these happy hormones. What does it do? Today 1 gram of that substance gave me that happiness. Tomorrow I need 2 grams. The day after tomorrow I need 5 grams. So it makes us addicted to that pleasure. Why? Because as I said, it is supposed to be a repeat action. When the dopamines are secreted when I drink water, it is also making me addicted to water in a sense, but not addicted in that sense of addiction itself. But it's a repeat action. But when this happens in my mind, I get addicted to this. How does it play about in our life? Let's look at it. We'll cut out all the science and see what is actually happening in the brain. There is a certain pleasure we feel in the human body, in the human mind. And that pleasure is always connected to a certain purpose. I eat food, I feel that happiness. I sleep, I feel that happiness. I drink water, I feel that happiness. I procreate, I feel that happiness. So each time this pleasure occurs to me in my mind, it is constantly connected to a certain purposeful action. Now when I introduce this drug or this substance, what am I doing? I am detaching pleasure from purpose. I am removing purpose from the picture and I am indulging purely in the pleasure. This happens in a very, very quick time frame when we are taking these substances. But if we look at our own lives, we are doing it every day. Simple thing, food that is more tasty but not nutritious. Isn't that precisely doing that? We are enjoying the pleasure. Why are we feeling that pleasure when we eat food? Because the food is good for the body. Now the nutrition of the food is zero. The pleasure component is very high. And that is why fatty foods are more addictive. Because it does precisely what substance abuse does to the mind. Something similar to that happens when people go out to gamble. Right? When they studied what happens when they're going to gamble, it's very interesting. They say, people think that winning in a gamble gives you a kick, right? You often think that you make a little money in a gambling game and that makes you addictive, you go back and start gambling again. Now they've found out winning is not addictive, but coming close to winning is addictive. That is why people who lose also keep going back to the game. Because coming close to winning and losing, or coming close to losing and winning, that point is what is addictive. Because that gives a spike in all of these excitatory hormones in the mind. And that becomes a repeat mechanism. The brain says, repeat that. You know, whatever you did gave me a kick. Repeat that, repeat that, repeat that. It becomes an addiction. So the general mistake which we always do in our life when we get too involved with the worldly life is we begin to separate pleasures from purpose. Pleasures are not wrong. Happiness is not wrong. But each of this pleasure comes attached to a certain purpose. And when we detach that purpose, that is where the problem comes. Now if we were to go back to what we were talking about as brahmacharya. Now let us see what Swami said when he said, for a grihastha, brahmacharya is following being a brahmachari in the presence of others other than their own spouse. And they found that this pleasure which is found in the form of conjugation with the opposite gender is very, very close to the pleasure that is found when you take all of these drugs. Right? The quantity of pleasure is almost the same. That is why it has to be held with as much care. Like when you take morphine for painkillers in the body, there's a very, very subtle balance in that because morphine is addictive, but at the same time morphine is useful when you're going through a certain procedure. So the doctor who is administering morphine, you know, gives it with that much care. So this pleasure which is found in this lascivious activities is very similar to the pleasure which comes with morphine, so it has to be handled with care. So what does Swami say? What is the purpose behind this pleasure? It is twofold, as Swami very clearly says. One is companionship. When you choose to have companionship with another person, and of course the other one is childbirth. Right? Because the human brain has two things programmed into it. Sustaining this body and propagating this body. self-preservation and self-propagation are two things which are programmed into this human brain. So this pleasure is attached to what we refer to as these two purposes. So when we involve in activities such as this only for the pleasure and not for the companionship, that is where you get into what we refer to as flippant relationships, isn't it? And that becomes a dangerous thing spiritually. I'm not talking about morality in society, what people will talk, that's a different thing. The reason why I'm speaking about this in a spiritual forum is because it has implications on our spiritual life and spiritual thinking. And the other thing is to indulge in the pleasures, detaching it from the purpose of childbirth. Please don't think that I'm a right-wing sympathizer who's saying that birth control is wrong. But it has a bearing on the human mind. And that is why very, very clearly Swami says, you know, one of the most beautiful distinguishing factors of Sanatana Dharma is, it says the purusharthas are dharma, artha, kama and moksha. To have pleasure in life is part of the human goal. It doesn't say that all pleasure is to be discarded. Swami so clearly says, dharma, artha, kama and moksha, which means the pursuit of wealth and the pursuit of pleasure should be within the bounds of dharma or righteousness. It is not that kama should not be pursued, but always it has to be attached to dharma. And that is why Swami says, when you're in a brahmachari phase, when you're in the student phase, the brahmacharya is expressed as complete continence, as complete celibacy. But when you go into this grihastha phase, it has to be expressed as controlled celibacy. It should not be completely given up. At the same time, it is controlled. And what is it controlled by? It is controlled by this purpose. And in fact, there's this very beautiful experiment they've done. They say this, you know, they took two groups of mice. Poor things, we always catch them and do all of these experiments, right? So one group was injected or were given water which was mixed with some of these substances. Like, I think the substance they used was cocaine. And the other thing was water. What they realized was, the rat, when it was alone, when it was kept alone in a cage, it always chose to drink the water which was having cocaine and was getting addicted to it. But the moment you put the rat in the company of others, in the sense of a social setting, where there are other things for the rat to do, you know, the rat, they call it the rat park. They make tunnels, they put balls, other things to keep the rat occupied. They say that the rat does not go near the cocaine water, it goes near regular water. And they say, if you're able to fill your life with purpose, then these pleasures which are addictive will not make you addictive. And that is precisely what Swami says. That constantly your eye should always be on the purpose of life. And automatically these pleasures will fall into the slots where they have to be. And they will not overlive. Swami gives a very beautiful example of the bumblebee or the honeybee. Swami says it is so powerful. Swami says it can burrow a hole through the bamboo and come out. But the same bee, when it is trapped in that flower, when it is enjoying the nectar, even when the flower closes, it stays there and it dies. Why? Because it has got addicted to that pleasure. And Swami says same is with the mind. Right? Swami says the mind is such a powerful tool that it can take you to divinity. But when it is kept obsessed with something as low as this, it gets caught up. And this is scientific, right? This is not spiritual mumbo jumbo. This is scientific. They have scientifically proved it. That when you focus on the pleasure traps you into an addictive cycle. Right? It makes you go through that over and over again and makes you lose focus on the purpose. Incidentally, you know, the Science Pious or the Thought for the Day, which is today, if you've not read it, probably you can go back and read that. Swami, very beautifully, whatever we are discussing today, Swami has mentioned in that. The reason why I went into that was, when we were editing the transcripts for the Thought for the Day, we read there this quote, "A thing of beauty is a joy forever." Right? These are famous lines from the English poet John Keats. So when you found this in the discourse, you're wondering, did really Swami quote John Keats? Or is it a translator's, you know, has taken the license to put in what he felt was an appropriate quote? So we went back to the discourse and Swami had really quoted these lines. He said, "A thing of beauty is a joy forever." But then Swami explains it further, very beautifully. He says, see, something which is beautiful will give you happiness. So what is beautiful? Is the world beautiful? Are the pleasures in the world beautiful? Are the objects in the world beautiful? Swami says, but that will not give you joy forever, because the beauty is not forever. The beauty itself is ephemeral. How can it give you joy which is forever? So Swami says, no. Who is eternal? Only God is eternal. So who is most beautiful? Only God is most beautiful. And Swami says, this whole process, yes, man is after beauty. Why? Because happiness is hidden in beauty. Swami says, andamlo anandamundi. Right? Andamlo, andam means beauty, anandamundi. Bliss is there. So this has been inbuilt into this human mechanism where we are constantly going after that happiness which is hidden in beauty. But Swami says, this body, Swami says, this is annamaya, right? It's made of food. This annamaya is the starting of that journey where you seek happiness from this body. Swami says, from the annamaya body, you have to go to the anandamaya divinity. God who is the very embodiment of bliss. But if you get lost in this annamaya body, that is what we defined. When you go after the pleasures of the body, it is also inbuilt in the mind that you will get addicted to that pleasure. So now if we were to redefine brahmacharya, what is this brahmacharya? Swami gives a very, very simple, probably I'll just read out a quote which Swami has given. Brahmacharya means whatever thoughts we entertain, whatever actions we perform, whatever enterprises we undertake, they should all be filled with the consciousness of Brahman. Conducting ourselves with the awareness that the divine is present everywhere is brahmacharya. It is not celibacy, it is not continence, it is not definitely bachelorhood. Swami says brahmacharya means brahmamlo charijutam, Swami would say. To constantly move in Brahman or consciousness is brahmacharya. And the moment you define it this way, you know that it is not a path, it's a goal. Right? It's a goal. None of us are there. But the path to that is this. Why, if we were to go back to the model which Swami often gives of the human apparatus that we all are, Swami says the outermost is the annamaya kosha, which is this body. And little subtler than that is the pranamaya kosha. And subtler than that is manomaya kosha, which is the sheath of the mind. And much deeper than that is the vijnanamaya kosha, and the innermost is the anandamaya kosha. So Swami says, you have to move inward from the annamaya happiness to the anandamaya happiness. And how is it done? At the appropriate time, in the appropriate manner, you let these pleasures be satisfied. Right? Swami would say that is the process of marriage itself. That through a dharmic process, you give expression to these pleasures so that they are always attached to the purpose and they don't come and bother me. Why? Because our pursuit should always be on the divinity. There is this interesting story in our scriptures, I mean in the Puranas. Most of you may be aware of it. It's a very cryptic story. Right? It's a very famous story. Most of us will be aware of it. It's the story of one king by name Kaushika who wants to become a Brahma Rishi. It's a different, we'll not go into the entire story because purely it starts with a process of jealousy. You know, there is this king, his name is Kaushika. He gets into a sort of a battle with sage Vasishta. And with all his might, with all his armies, he is not able to defeat this single man sage. So he says, my God, he has something which I don't have. Let me pursue it. So then he figures out that Vasishta is a Brahma Rishi. Brahma Rishi is nothing but a symbolism, right? Brahma Rishi is probably the Brahmachari who has reached that ultimate stage, isn't it? What Swami referred or defined as Brahmacharya is what a Brahma Rishi has mastered. So this king says, I want to reach that stage. So he gives up his kingdom and then he starts doing penance. He starts doing rigorous penance, and the Puranas say hundreds and hundreds of years. So when he does this penance, in between, Brahma comes and he says, I'm very pleased with you. So he names him a Raja Rishi, which means a sage who was once a king. So he's not pleased with that. Because when you say a Raja, when you say a king, it denotes Rajas, right? Raja means that quality of Rajas or that aggression which comes with being a warrior, being a Kshatriya. So he names him a Raja Rishi. You know, you're a Rishi, but you still have that Rajas in you. So he is not pleased. He goes back and he does more meditation in hundreds of years. And finally, as always, Indra gets a little perturbed. Indra in the legend is the king of all the gods. But Swami has very, very clearly said, Indra is nothing but the mind. Right? Indra represents the mind. If you read through the entire Vedas with this understanding that Indra represents the mind, the way you will understand it will be completely different. Right? So Swami says, Indra represents the mind. So now this mind gets perturbed. Why? Because the role of the mind is that. The role of the mind is to take care of this body. If you lose body consciousness, what will the mind do? So the mind constantly tries to drag you back into body consciousness. Very innocently it does that. There is no maligned intention there. So what does this Indra do? He sends an Apsara, a heavenly damsel. He sends a damsel by name Menaka. And this again is a symbolism. Why? An Apsara is supposed to be somebody who does not age, who is ever young, and who is extremely beautiful, unearthly beauty. And they say that is precisely the fantasy of a human being. To have beauty that does not fade with age. And like other women, she will not bear children, but she will bear if she wants. So it becomes like what we just referred. Pleasure that does not diminish with age and time. Pleasure that is not attached to any purpose. So the mind begins to send something like that. The mind is trying to draw this Rishi who is trying to master his mind or become a Brahmachari in the true sense. What is the distraction Indra sends? He sends the distraction of pure pleasure, not attached to any purpose. And he falls for it. Right? He falls for it. And in the process, the story goes that Menaka also falls in love with the Rishi and she bears a child. That's why some of these stories are not purely one-dimensional. Because this sage Kaushika, then he gives birth to a daughter by name Shakuntala, who Shakuntala marries Dushyanta. And Dushyanta and Shakuntala give birth to the great king Bharata, after whom this land is named. Bharat name has come from that Bharata. He was one of the most righteous kings to have ruled this continent or this subcontinent. Right? So that is a different story altogether, that the greatest king that we had was born from a Rishi. Right? From somebody who wanted to conquer himself, not conquer the worldly realm. But he falls for her, then he loses. They say thousands of years of penance, what he has gathered, he loses. But then eventually he discovers that this was a ploy of the, the lord of the gods, Indra. So what does he do? He curses Menaka. What is the curse he gives? You will never come close to me. He says, henceforth, you will never be able to come close to me. It is not a curse. It's a resolve that he takes, isn't it? And elsewhere, Swami very beautifully explains, this is, if you look at it from the point of view of divine play, here is a very sincere aspirant who wants to conquer his own pleasures and conquer his own mind. Why would God be so cruel? Right? That's what we would think. Why would God be so cruel to disturb his penance? Swami says, no, God gave him an opportunity to know where his limitations lie. God gave him an opportunity to see where his flaw in character is so that he can correct it. And that's precisely what the sage does. Kaushika does precisely that. He says, henceforth, you will never come close to me. And of course, he has one more stage to go where once again the mind tries to, Indra sends another apsara, but this time he gets very angry and he curses her. And the moment he curses her, he realizes, I have conquered lust, but I have not conquered anger. So then he starts working on his anger. Then eventually he attains that stage where Brahma comes and says, you are a Brahma Rishi. And he names him Vishwamitra. Right? And Vishwamitra is called Vishwamitra because he is the friend of the entire humanity because he gave the Gayatri Mantra. Right? So imagine this is the process that each one of us have to go through. And it is clearly available, but Swami says, all of this, don't worry about going into all of this. It is very simple. Constantly seek only God. That is the bottom line. Through all travails in life, through all distractions in life, through all phases in life, are you always seeking only God? Because when you seek God, you automatically have to lead a dharmic life. Right? You are constantly, Swami says, it's simply only that. When you are a student, ask yourself, what is your duty? When you're a householder, ask yourself, what is your duty? When you're a father or a mother, ask yourself, what is your duty? And Swami says, when you grow beyond the stage, at a certain point, you have to understand that the duty as a householder has come to an end. Right? That is when you graduate to the stage of a vanaprastha or somebody who lives like living in the forest. And one simple definition Swami gives. What is the vanaprastha stage? The husband and wife must live like brother and sister. There is companionship, there is dependence on each other, but they will live as brother and sister. I'll probably end with this very interesting story of a devotee. This devotee came to Swami in the 1960s, and when he came to Swami, he was an extremely rich gentleman. And in the initial years, Swami had told him that, you're going to have some ups and downs in life, but hold on to Swami with faith, and I will get you through all of that. And this is something that you have to go through. So in the process, what happened? He was a very, very rich businessman. He lost heavily in business. He lost all his money. Finally, he came to the streets. And all through this process, when he was rich, he was very, very close to Swami, right? He would come to Swami, he would come to Parthi. He would say that he would park his car. In those days, there was no Ganesh temple, right? That's where the cars used to be parked. So he would come, park his car, and walk straight up to Swami's room. That was the kind of access he had to Swami. Even when he was going through that, imagine devotees around Swami tell him, no, all this attention Swami is giving you because you are rich. Because Swami has something to get out of you. People around Swami are telling him this. So this man dismisses it. He says it's impossible. Swami cannot be like that. Because as a businessman, he must have seen many, many people like that. Right? Who are so selfish and self-centered. He says, no, Swami cannot be like that. But that is how Swami tests. Right? Over the years, he starts losing in his business, he starts becoming poor, and as he's becoming poor, the distance between him and Swami starts increasing. then it comes to a point where he loses everything. He's got nothing. Right? He says, no business. Every day we have to wonder about what we're going to do for the next day's food. From being an extremely rich businessman, he comes to that stage. And what is his equation with Swami? Swami does not even look at his face. This is when the mind starts playing up, right? My God, so it is true. Is it true that Swami will not talk to you if he does not have anything to gain from you? So he said, no, I cannot accept this. So he says, I will put an end to this thinking. I will go to Prashanti Nilayam and I will wait there till Swami speaks to me. So he makes a few trips. Every time he comes, Swami does not even look at him. Swami does not even acknowledge his presence. He's extremely hurt by this. So finally he tells his wife, he says, I'm going to Parthi. I don't know how long it is going to take, but till Swami speaks to me, I'm not coming back. He says, I have to put this thought to rest in my mind. So he comes to Parthi. Days go by, weeks go by. Swami does not even look at him. So he says, he does not have much resources. He's come with a little bit of money. He says, over the days, the 3 meals becomes 2 meals a day. The 2 meals becomes only breakfast a day. The 3 idlis for breakfast becomes 2 idlis, 1 idli. And he is not able to afford anymore. Swami is not recognizing him, but everybody in the ashram recognizes him because he had so much access to Swami. So he would say that people will come and ask him, why are you not eating well? Why are you not coming to the canteen for lunch? So what he would do? He says, I would enter through one door, simply linger around the canteen and come back so that people will think that I'm going and eating my food. So he went on like this for a few days without food. Then somebody helps him with a little bit of money. So he goes on for almost, I think, 2 months or something like that. He's sitting. One day he's sitting in the mandir. And he's thinking in his mind, what is it, Swami? Why are you doing this to me? I refuse to take the argument that you're not talking to me because I don't have money. Tell me what else it is. So he started looking into his mind, is there anything that Swami has told me to do which I've not been able to do, which I can start doing now? So he was constantly, rummaging through his memories. What is it that Swami wants? What is it that Swami wants? And Swami is giving darshan there, right? Swami is on the lady's side. He's looking at Swami, when will you talk to me? And as he's thinking about it, he remembers that many times in his conversation with Swami, very jokingly Swami has told, he said, you have 4 children, how much more do you want? How long are you going to live like this in worldly life? When are you going to come out of it? And he was just about Swami's age, so very like a friend making fun of another friend, Swami would say this. And he would also say something and just handle the situation. So that day he thought, this is something that Swami had told me. And sitting there, of course he was not at home, but sitting there in his mind he thought, Swami, from today I cease to live a life of a householder, even though being in marriage. In his mind he made a resolve. He said, Swami, this is what you wanted. From today I cease to be a householder in my grihastha life. And he made that resolve. He saw Swami turning there. Just that one thought, Swami turned, walked straight to where he was, came to him and said, Ah, Bangaru, when did you come? And of course he burst out into tears. He said, Swami, I've been here for 2 months. Swami said, I know. And Swami said, it is not that I'm not talking to you because you don't have money. Hold on to faith. Whether Swami speaks to you or not, whether Swami is next to you or not, Swami is always with you. Don't forget that. Go back. Face your problems with that courage that Swami is with you. You will get through it. As we go through that life, that is all which is important. As long as the focus is on Swami, right? As long as the focus is on the goal, every other hurdle can be crossed over. Sometimes we might fall, right? The great Vishwamitra fell. Who are you and me, right? But as long as the focus is there, the discipline will automatically come. The dharma will automatically be infused in the life. But we have to be conscious of that. And that is why Swami said, that is why brahmacharya or celibacy is synonymous to purity. See, when we talk about purity, there's a difference between transformation and purification. Transformation is you're something, you become something else. Purification is you are something, but you have some impurities, you become a pure self. So when we talk of celibacy or brahmacharya as purity, it is there within each one of us. So this process is to bring out that purity from within, or remove all of these impurities which make this brahmacharya impure. And for that we don't have to go to the stage of sannyasa or remain a celibate or remain a bachelor all the time. Right? You can be a bachelor, but if your focus is not on God, how will you be a brahmachari? Right? Because clearly Swami says a brahmachari is one who is constantly thinking about Brahman, who is constantly craving to reach the Lord. If that craving is not there, you could have controlled your mind, you could have controlled all of your senses, you could have controlled all of your distractions, but will you be a brahmachari? A brahmachari is defined by that craving to reach Brahman. And that has to be preserved through these various stages of life. And that is the royal road of brahmachari. It is, you know, that is the problem with Swami, or that is the greatness about Swami's message. In every part of the message, there is the entire message. What did we start off with? Ashtanga Yoga, one part is Yama. In Yama, five parts, in that one is brahmacharya. But in brahmacharya is contained the entire message too. So even if you follow that one, you will be following the entire body of Swami's message. So with these few words, thank you all for your very, very patient listening. I join you all in offering gratitude to Swami for explaining all of these things so very clearly and beautifully, so that we can follow these and redeem our lives. I offer this humble effort at Swami's lotus feet.
Listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.